capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to this week's Level Talk program. My name is John Harrison. Last week, we broadcast a program about the pros and cons of the gig economy inside the Western world. Now, the overall conclusion from that program was that the gig economy actually, which already accounts for between 20 and 30% of jobs in the United States of America, for example, and is growing fast, was positive. Although some serious concerns were raised about the social implications of the switchover from being an employee with all associated rights to that of a sort of permanent freelancer with virtually no rights. Although it was recognised in the programme that the traditional working place as such is fading fast. But what about the non-Western world, in countries with underdeveloped economies, where there's probably a greater opportunity for exploitation, at the same time a greater opportunity for meaningful positive changes? To discuss these issues, I welcome the programme Professor Helena Barnard, who is one of the authors of a recent report compiled by the Oxford Internet Institution called The Risks and Rewards of Online Gig Work at the Global Margins. Professor Helena Barnard is the Director of Research at the University of Pretoria's Gordon Institute of Business Science. I also welcome to the programme Jonathan Davis, an economist and wealth advisor based in London. Welcome both of you to the programme.
Hello, John.
Hello.
Okay, now let me just ask you, please, a sort of initial question. Firstly, in which developing countries is gig work most prevalent and growing the fastest? And why these countries? May I ask you, Professor Barlin, to start?
Gig work is, by its very nature, quite distributed. So when we did the study, we found respondents from all over the world. We did find that certain countries seem to have a greater presence, for example, the Philippines. In Nigeria, there's actually a ministry trying to encourage it, so it's not surprising that it's more prevalent there than in some other countries. But I think one of the characteristics of online gig work is precisely that it is quite widely distributed.
Okay, that in itself is interesting. So what sort of forms of online platforms are we talking about? In a nutshell, my question is, are these sites that allow the hirer to communicate directly with the supplier, or are there intermediaries involved?
Well, the answer to that is actually both. There are sites that you can directly, as a potential buyer, you can place a job, and potential suppliers can then bid for that job and can communicate, and the buyer can find out more from selection of shortlisted people. There are also places where the price at which a job can be done is fixed. So if you want to buy there, you know that I'm going to go to the site and I'm going to buy at a set price. And the reverse is true, so that the person who is both the provider and the buyer can set a price and can actually initiate that conversation. Most of these are not moderated. So there isn't a quality controller acting as an intermediary, but there are also sites where there's a quality controller. So there would be, for example, a form of training and pre-selection, and the people who are on that site, there's a guarantee of a certain quality that will be delivered.
I take issue with this thing about moderating. It's very regulations that somehow there has to be some big brother or some big head honcho running the show. No, I think that is not what we want. The suppliers of services, the people doing the gig economy, they don't want head honchos. They're making money by providing their intellectual and other services through the internet, perhaps to customers thousands of miles away. They don't want people getting involved. They want to be able to just provide that service and make some money. And that's why this is growing hand over fist, because there are customers who want the services and there are suppliers who want to provide the services. Just let them get on with it.
Okay. Professor Barnard.
I think what we're seeing in the market is a diversity of offerings in the market. So there are individuals who will want to buy. Let's say you're looking for a transcription service. You've done some interviews and you want to transcribe it. There are some people who want to buy it at the lowest possible price, and there are some people who would say, I'm willing to pay more, but then I want to have a certain level of quality. So what we are seeing is that there are different types of sites, and some of these sites and part of the service that the site is offering is an internal process of quality control or moderation where they will not allow you to be a provider there unless you meet their quality criteria. Then there are other sites where basically anybody who wants to try a hand at it can try and become a provider on that site. So I just want to make it clear that what we're seeing in the emergence of these online platforms is also the emergence of a new type of market with a wide variety of offerings, and that it's perhaps a good idea to differentiate between different types of buyers as much as different types of suppliers.
Yeah. Can I just ask you a question quickly, Professor Barnard? You mentioned there's two different sites. Those sites which try to in some way regulate, perhaps another word, quality control could be another description to label those sites. And those sites where it's just like basically direct connection between a buyer and provider. Now, can you give us any figures, statistics, how many of each we're talking about?
It's incredibly hard to do it because this is a typical growing market, so there's not yet a lot of consolidation.
Yeah.
And there are specific sites. So there would be a site for voiceover or for design work or for specific music industry or for economists. So there's a wide variety of these sites. And well, precisely because it's a growing market and we're not quite sure how to regulate it, even if we wanted to, it's extremely hard to get a handle on it. However, what we are knowing is that on the large platforms of the double-sided ones where both parties can post and directly communicate, we are talking about millions of participants on the platforms.
Yep. Okay. Now, Jonathan, I'd like to ask you to outline, please, to me and to listeners, what are the positive effects of the gig economy here? All sorts of stories about the negative. What about the positive effects? How do you see this sort of good things about this new gig economy being, from your point of view?
We in the West, we have very high business costs, living costs, largely, perhaps for another show, largely as a result of central bank and government policies, our cost of doing business is so high. So, if we can achieve the same ends, if we can obtain the same services at a lower cost, and therefore our bottom line, our profit rises, well, of course, that's one of the objectives of capitalism, of free markets. It's what keeps the thing going. It keeps the economy going, that businesses prosper and grow. So we can, of course, recruit and employ people locally, but the fact is they cost X. If we can find the same X service, quality of service, for a half of the price, a quarter of the price, a tenth of the price, we'd be absolutely mad not to take advantage of it. So the customers, there's an obvious benefit. The suppliers, say you have grown up with a pretty good education, but there's absolutely no job opportunities in your, for example, war-torn or hugely socialist environment, and basically your economy is shot to pieces. Get yourself a mobile phone, get yourself a cheap computer and access to the internet. Suddenly, you could be making $5 in a day, which might have been, perhaps the professor can tell us more clearly, but that could have been a month's wages, perhaps. So, of course.
Okay, thank you. And I've got a whole list of points I'd like to bring up, but you just brought up another one. I'd like to just raise that one quiz. If that is a situation and we're in a sort of race to the bottom as far as pay goes, so wages, my question would be, as a sort of sociologist, I suppose, who's going to would pay for the education that one would need to be able to fulfill these jobs?
I think it's unlikely a totally desolate economy will not support gig work. There needs to be a basic level of skills. There needs to be English language skills and literacy.
Yeah.
There needs to be internet connection and good enough internet connection to meet the quality requirements of a customer abroad. So we do not see that the people who take advantage of it are the really poor people. They tend to be quite well educated, and we did a survey.
Right. So we're not talking about Mozambique. We're talking more about Thailand, the Philippines, places like that. Is that sort of what you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. If they're Mozambicans, they tend to be the elite in Mozambique. Yeah. And they are, if you're a highly skilled person in a scarce skilled country, you tend to have good options locally. So we're talking about middle-income countries that are producing people who have finished high school, very often have gotten some form of a tertiary education, but are not being absorbed by the local labor market for various reasons. So at the moment, what we see is that the education systems of those countries are somewhat functioning. They're not utterly dysfunctional. Right. So most people will have gone and they will have received a not quite adequate government secondary education and then perhaps a tertiary education at a private institution, something like that.
Yeah.
And there is definitely what we observe. So the term that's often used is virtual migration. So instead of having people physically living in the UK or wherever and having to pay expenses in the UK, they could earn in the UK, but they have the same living costs. Some part of that is happening, but there are lots of...
Yeah.
Of course, reality is more complex than you just tap into the opportunities abroad. And there is a bit of a race to the bottom. And it comes from two places. The first place is it is extremely hard to overestimate the overabundance of suppliers there. The competition for a single job, many of the respondents to whom we spoke said it almost feels like a lottery whether or not you get the job. By the time somebody needs some data entry done, so it's not complex work, it needs some sort of attention to detail, there may be 500-600 people applying for the same job. So there are more suppliers and, mm-hmm. and there are, of course, more suppliers the lower the skills level of the job. As the jobs become more complex, the supplier base also shrinks.
Well, shrink. Yeah, okay. Just very quickly, I'd like to bring Jonathan in here. Jonathan, I mean, you're hearing this, the other side of the argument. I also take on board your point of view that this is sort of pure capitalism in a way, you know, the market rules. But having just listened to what we've just been hearing, both of us, about education levels and so on, are you not worried that the growth of the gig economy will actually lead to a degradation of the infrastructure in third world countries, not an improvement? Or do you see it being an improvement?
I'm not worried about that at all.
You're not worried about that at all, right?
Not in the slightest. I mean, the people there providing these services, this is the first time in human history they've been able to provide these services virtually. First time ever. First time they've had an opportunity to make money from someone 1,000 or 10,000 miles away. This is absolutely, utterly fantastic. And it's just nascent. Yeah. It's been going, 5 years? Google is only 10 years old. It's one of the most valuable companies on the planet. These things take a bit of time. I get the point that there are potentially hundreds of people trying to get the same job. Well, partly that's because those buying the service, we aren't used to it yet. In fact, do you know what? It's an honest truth. Literally, I only heard about Fiverr with a double R on the end about 3 months ago. And I'm not bad on internet type things. So it shows you that it's taking time to get through. No, the more this takes hold, the more people become comfortable with providing the service and receiving the service, then the more there will be a greater equilibrium between suppliers and demand. This is absolutely fantastic. What I'm worried about is that governments are going to try and get hold of this and tax it out of existence. That's what I'm worried about.
Okay, that's a very good point, and I'd like to return to that point after a very short break.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to the Level Talk program. Today I'm talking to Professor Helena Barnard, Director of Research at the University of Pretoria's Gorton Institute of Business Science, and Jonathan Davis, an economist and wealth advisor based in London, about the international aspects of the gig economy. Welcome back, everybody. You just touched on a very important point there, Jonathan. I mean, you say that you're worried about governments coming in and taxes this out in existence. Now, on the other hand, I'd like to ask you, Professor Barnard, do you think that this economy can develop in the way that it's developing forever without any kind of regulation at all, without any kind of guidelines being set up? Or do you agree with Jonathan, who's saying that just leave it to the market and the market will regulate itself?
We know from the history of innovation that what happens with innovations is that when they first introduced the huge promise, and we do not understand the dark side of the innovation. And then there tends to be some overreach. It happened the 1929 stock market, the Great Depression, was the dark side of discovering the very real benefit of having shares in a company rather than just rich people owning shares. So there are hundreds of examples. And I'm quite sure that we find it extremely hard to understand in what ways this can do damage, and we will regulate it once that damage has happened. That's just the history of innovation that we know from the history of innovation. We can try and anticipate what are some of the things that may go wrong. So the one thing that can go wrong is these opportunities at doing low-skilled work in developing countries and paying much less for it. What is it doing in the home country, in the wealthier home countries? So who are previously, if you were not university material, there were good jobs out there and people could do good jobs and people could raise families. I'm based in South Africa and this is a country where the social fabric has torn. And we live with the consequences of people who feel that society has abandoned them. So the one dark side of it is actually a dark side in the UK or the US or wherever, where these jobs are being shifted all over the world to people who are willing to pay less, and people who are insiders in the economy are doing better. But as a society, we need to figure out what are our responsibilities to potentially vulnerable people inside our societies.
Okay, Professor Barnard, I think, you know, we understand your point and I think it's very valid. But on the other hand, I'd like to sort of back Jonathan here, you know, produce the argument that actually we've kind of gone overboard perhaps in the other way. Our services cost too much. Our education costs too much. We're almost sort of, education is feeding on education and education is feeding on more education. And we're sort of losing touch with the real marketplace and the real supply and demand situation. And perhaps its introduction a vast, almost unlimited pool of talent out there is a good thing for our own system as well as a bad thing.
It may be. And the point is that
right.
This is why it's so hard to anticipate the consequences. It could, on the one hand, be really a wake-up call for action, or it could entrench attitudes and it could introduce a kind of an inertia. So that's the one concern, and it's something that we need to be mindful of as this unfolds. What is the kind of regulation that we would like to see that will allow us to reap the economic benefit of this without causing more damage than good? We want this, in the end, to bring more good than bad.
Okay, just very brief, because I'd like to ask Jonathan to rebut, if you like, what you've just been saying.
Professor, do you know many people in the gig economy personally who have improved their financial situation because they've been able to provide services to people hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of miles away?
Individuals who are working in the UK, in South Africa, or in Lesotho? Because there are individuals at all three of those tiers of income.
And did they need regulation? Did they need government? Did they need... It doesn't matter.
Okay, well, can we just focus, please, on the third world? Let's take a worker in the Philippines, Professor Barnard, or...
So the ones I know are either in South Africa, which is a middle-income country, or they're in one of the poorer neighbours of South Africa. And there is most definitely a sense of arbitrage. The most valuable opportunities still are the opportunities where you are in some way directly tied. So we spoke about a woman who does a lot of court transcription, because if you want to do court transcription, you have to be physically present before you can do the transcription. She said it protects her in some way from the global competition. So she appreciated the opportunity of being protected from global competition, and in the South African case, it was possible to get more money if you could somehow be tied to the South African economy rather than competing on the open market. If you went to the lower income countries, the balance started to shift and people were prepared to compete with Filipinos, for example. What we are seeing is that there's a very real sense of trying to figure out what are the opportunities that are available to me locally and using that to judge whether an opportunity on the gig economy is attractive or not.
Exactly. That's my point, Professor. That's my point. Everyone providing these services are like little businesses. And, you know, as they get into it, as they learn, as they grow and experience the provision of the service, they'll create their own employment securities. They'll learn about marketing, about selling, about business development. They'll learn about what's the best way of taking their service to the market. Just let them get on with it. They will make money that way. If they're any good, they'll make a lot of money. If they're not any good, well, they better not be in this business. They better go and do something else.
Okay, I think we've heard both sides of that argument. Thank you very much. And listeners, I think can sort of, I feel like a judge here. You know, let's move on to the next theme. And actually, my next theme is a bit of an odd one, I suppose, but it's one that sort of I'm interested in. In this decade, you know, when many countries are trying to prevent migration and using the old age-old arguments about, you know, how migrants take our jobs away from us and all that stuff. Does online gig work not undermine the whole process of protecting workers' positions and rights? Jonathan?
In the ultimate conclusion, the ultimate logic is anything to do with intelligence can be exported. Clearly, we exported from the West a lot of our manufacturing jobs. We've been exporting for years, many years, things like accountancy jobs. So, yes, anything to do with a mind and a computer can be exported. But I go with the big picture that throughout history, wherever we've tried to receive a service or a good, cheaper and better quality, we've always migrated there. And that ultimately has helped society. When you think about over the last 40 years, how many hundreds of millions of people in abject poverty in the emerging markets are now actually self-sufficient. They are actually making money. They're no longer in abject, dire situations because we've exported manufacture. If we could also export services and intelligence, I'd be absolutely delighted, because what that would mean is it would reduce the cost of my business, and therefore it would help me and my business do other things, because that's how the free market works. It will create more employment and job and business opportunities.
Okay, just very quickly, Jonathan, I'd just like to ask you again the question. Will the development of the gig economy make it stupid and pointless to build barriers between countries and stop migrants? Because one of the reasons that migrants migrate is because they want to find work.
I think politics will put up barriers, not economics so much. I don't get the idea or you know, there are 25 walls, quote unquote, in the world. So I was reading recently. I think it's more about politics than economics.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Professor Barnard, your opinion, please, on the situation with migration and the, you know, the sort of new, I don't know, identity politics that are creeping in everywhere and all sorts of political platforms all over the place. And relating that to what's happening in the gig economy, please.
So migration happens for many reasons. There's economic migration, and then there's migration that happens because people are scared of being victims of crime or of political persecution.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the effect will be on economic migration. It may well have some, at this point, because we don't know the scope of the phenomenon, we're not sure where it's going to end. If it continues to grow, yes, mm-hmm. it will mm-hmm. offer opportunities, and it is more likely to have economic migrants stay at home. I don't think the reason why we're seeing an absolute inflow of migrants into Europe at the moment has to do primarily with economics. So it's not going to solve Europe's migrant crisis. It may make it easier for the US to deal with the influx of Mexicans.
Yeah, okay, got your point. There's a big difference between economic migration and refugee status and other reasons. Fair enough. Okay, well, it's been one of these programs that we've had a good discussion, yet I feel we've got nowhere. There's so much to talk about. There's so many different arguments that we haven't really had the time to argue properly. But we shall come back to this scene probably over and over again, because it is one of the most important subjects, tendencies, trends facing us in this century that we live in. And I'd like to thank you, Professor Helena Barner, Director of Research at the University of Pretoria's Gordon Institute of Business Science, and also you, Jonathan Davis, an economist and wealth advisor based in London. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Tune in again next week. Level Talk. Goodbye.